closer!"
Harry's wand directed the tiny jewel into the troll's mouth.
"Finite! Incantatum!"
The troll's head blew off its spine as the rock expanded back into its old form, and Harry stepped aside as the enemy's body crashed where he'd been standing. The enemy's head was already beginning to regenerate, the ragged stump of the jaw and spine smoothing over, the mouth completing itself and replacing its teeth. Harry bent down and picked up the troll's head by its left ear. His wand jammed through the troll's left eye, plunging through the jelly-like material and passing through the wide socket in the bone. Harry visualized a 1 millimeter-wide cross-section through the enemy's brain and transfigured it into sulfuric acid. The enemy stopped regenerating. Harry threw the corpse over the edge of the terrace and turned back to Hermione. Her eyes were moving and focused on him. Harry scrambled down beside her, ignoring the blood soaking more of his already soaked robes.
"You'll be all right?"
His brain formed the sentence, but his lips wouldn't move.
"You'll be all right. We'll find some magic to fix all this. Put you back to normal. Just hold on. Don't..."
Hermione's lips were moving. Just a tiny bit, but they were moving.
"Your fault."
Time froze. Harry should have told her not to talk, to save her breath, only he couldn't unblock his lips. Hermione drew in another breath, and her lips whispered,
"Not your fault."
Then she exhaled and closed her eyes. Harry stared at her with his mouth half open, his breath caught in his throat.
"Don't do this,"
said his voice. He'd only been 2 minutes late. Hermione suddenly convulsed, her arms twitching into the air as though reaching up for something, and her eyes flew open again. There was a burst of something that was magic and also more. A shout, louder than an earthquake and containing 1,000 books, 1,000 libraries, all spoken in a single cry that was Hermione. Too vast to be understood, except that Harry suddenly knew that Hermione had whited out the pain and was glad not to be dying alone. For a moment it seemed like the outpouring of magic might hold, take root in the castle's stone. But then the outpouring ended and the magic faded, her body stopped moving, and all motion halted as Hermione Jean Granger ceased to exist. "No." Harry stood up from the body, swaying. "No." There was a burst of flame, and Dumbledore was standing there with Fawkes, his eyes filled with horror.
"I felt a student die. What?"
The old wizard's eyes saw what lay upon the ground.
"Oh, no,"
whispered Albus Dumbledore. Fawkes gave a sad, mournful croon.
"Bring her back."
There was silence on the terrace. Fred Weasley had risen up into the air at a gesture from Dumbledore's wand and was floating towards them, surrounded by a reassuring pink glow.
"Harry,"
the old wizard began. His voice cracked.
"Harry!"
"Have Fawkes cry on her or whatever. Hurry up!"
The voice that spoke sounded perfectly calm.
I can't, Harry. It's too late. She's dead."
"I don't want to hear about it. If it was me lying there, you'd pull some kind of amazing rabbit out of your hat and save me, right? Because the hero isn't allowed to die before the story's over. Well, she's the hero too. So whatever you were saving for that extra special occasion, just go ahead and use it now. I promise I'll pay you back.
There isn't anything I can do. Her soul has departed. She's passed on.
Harry opened his mouth to scream out all his fury, and then closed it again. There wasn't any point in screaming. It wouldn't accomplish anything. The unbearable pressure rising inside him couldn't be let out that way. Harry turned away from Dumbledore and looked down at where the remains of Hermione Granger were lying in a pool of blood. Part of his mind was hammering at the world around him, trying to make it go away, wake up from the nightmare and find himself back in his Ravenclaw dorm room with the morning sun shining through the curtains. But the blood remained, and Harry didn't wake up, and another part of him already knew that this event was real. Part of the same flawed world that included Azkaban and the Wizengamot Chamber and... No. With a fracturing feeling, as though time was still torn to pieces around him, Harry turned away from Dumbledore and looked down at the remains of Hermione Granger lying in a pool with two tourniquets tied around her thigh stumps, and decided...
No, I do not accept this. There isn't any reason to accept it. Not when there's magic in the world.
Harry would learn whatever he had to learn. Invent whatever he had to invent. Rip the knowledge of Salazar Slytherin from the Dark Lord's mind. Discover the secret of Atlantis, open any gates or break any seals necessary. Find his way to the root of all magic and reprogram it. He would rip apart the foundations of reality itself to get Hermione Granger back.
The crisis is over, the defense professor said. You may dismount, madam.
Trelawney, who had been sitting behind him on the two-person broomstick that had just blazed through Hogwarts, burning directly through all the walls and floors in their way, hastily pulled herself off and then sat down hard on the floor, a pace away from the red glowing edges of a newly made gap in the wall. The woman was still breathing in gasps, bending over herself as though she were on the verge of vomiting out something larger than she was. The defense professor had felt the boy's horror through the link that existed between the two of them, the resonance in their magic, and he had realized that the boy had sought the troll and found it. The defense professor had tried to send an impulse to retreat, to don the cloak of invisibility and flee, but he'd never been able to influence the boy through the resonance, and hadn't succeeded that time either. He'd felt the boy give himself over fully to the killing intention. That was when the defense professor had begun burning through the substance of Hogwarts, trying to reach the battle in time. He'd felt the boy exterminate his enemy in seconds. He'd felt the boy's dismay as one of his friends died. He had felt the fury the boy had directed at some annoyance, who was likely Dumbledore, followed by an unknown resolution whose unyielding hardness even he found adequate. With any luck, the boy had just discarded his foolish little reluctances. Unseen by anyone, the defense professor's lips curved up in a thin smile. Despite its little ups and downs, On the whole, this had been a surprisingly good day.
He is here, the one who will tear apart the very stars in heaven. He is here. He is the end of the world.
Chapter 90. Roles, Part 1. A simple innovate from the headmaster had awakened Fred Weasley, followed by a preliminary healing charm for a broken arm and cracked ribs. Harry's voice had distantly told the headmaster about the transfigured acid inside the troll's head. Dumbledore had looked down over the side of the terrace and made a gesture before returning, and then about the Weasley twins' minds having been tampered with, carrying on a separate conversation that Harry remembered, but could not process. Harry stood over Hermione's body. He hadn't moved from that spot, thinking as fast as he could through the sense of dissociation and fragmented time. Was there anything he should be doing now? Any opportunities that were passing irrevocably? Some way to reduce the amount of magical omnipotence that would be required later. A temporal beacon effect to mark this instant for later time travel, if he someday found a way to travel back further than 6 hours. There were theories of time travel under general relativity, which had seemed much less plausible before Harry had run across time-turners. And those theories said you couldn't go back to before the time machine was built. A relativistic time machine maintained a continuous pathway through time. It didn't teleport anything. But Harry didn't see anything helpful he could do using spells in his lexicon. Dumbledore wasn't being very cooperative, and in any case, this was several minutes after the critical location within time.
"Harry,"
the headmaster whispered, laying his hand on Harry's shoulder. He'd vanished from where he was standing over the Weasley twins and come into existence beside Harry. George Weasley had discontinuously teleported from where he was sitting to be kneeling next to his brother's side, and Fred was now lying straight with his eyes open and wincing as he breathed.
"Harry, you must go from this place."
"Hold on," said Harry's voice. "I'm trying to think if there's anything else I can do."
The old wizard's voice sounded helpless.
"Harry, I know you do not believe in souls, but whether Hermione is watching you now or no, I do not think she would wish for you to be like this."
No, it was obvious. Harry leveled his wand at Hermione's body.
"Harry, what are you?"
And poured everything down his arm into his hand.
"Frigidiro."
"Doing?"
"Hypothermia,"
Harry said distantly as he staggered. It had been one of the spells he and Hermione had experimented on a lifetime ago, so he was able to control it precisely, though it had taken a lot of power to affect that much mass. Hermione's body should now be at almost exactly 5 degrees Celsius.
"People have been revived from cold water after more than 30 minutes without breathing. The cold protects you from brain damage, you see. It slows everything down. There's a saying Muggle doctors have, 'You're not dead until you're warm and dead.' I think they even cool down the patient during some surgeries, if they have to stop someone's heart for a while."
Fred and George started sobbing. Dumbledore's face was already streaked with tears.
"I'm sorry,"
he whispered.
"Harry, I'm so sorry, but you have to stop this."
The headmaster took Harry by the shoulders and pulled on him. Harry allowed himself to be turned away from Hermione's body, walked forward as the headmaster pushed him away from the blood. The cooling charm would buy him time. Hours, at least. Maybe days, if he could manage to keep casting the spell on Hermione, or if they stored her body somewhere cold. Now there was time to think. Minerva had seen Albus's face, and she had known something was wrong. There had been time for her to wonder what had happened, and even who had died. Her mind flashing to Alistair, to Augusta, to Arthur and Molly, all the most likely targets at the start of Voldemort's second rise. She had thought that she had steeled herself. She had thought herself ready for the worst. Then Albus spoke, and all the steel left her.
"Not Hermione? No."
Albus gave her a brief space to weep, and then told her that Harry Potter, who had watched Miss Granger die, had seated himself outside the infirmary storeroom where Miss Granger's remains were being kept, refusing to move from the spot and telling anyone who spoke to him to go away so he could think. The only thing that had elicited any reaction from the boy was when Fawkes had tried to sing to him. Harry Potter had shrieked at the Phoenix not to do that. His feelings were real. He didn't want magic to try to heal them like they were a disease. After that, Fawkes had refused to sing again. Albus thought that she might have the best chance of reaching Harry Potter now. So she had to pull herself together and clean up her face. There would be time later for private grief, when her surviving children no longer needed her. Minerva McGonagall pulled together the dislocated pieces of herself, wiped her eyes a final time, and laid her hand on the doorknob of the infirmary section, whose back storeroom was now being used. For the second time this century, and for the fifth time since the castle of Hogwarts had been raised, as the resting place of a promising young student. She opened the door. Harry Potter's eyes gazed at her. The boy was sitting on the floor in front of the door to the back storeroom, and holding his wand in his lap. If those eyes were grieving, if they were empty, if they were even broken, it couldn't be seen from looking at the boy's face. There were no dried tears on those cheeks.
"Why are you here, Professor McGonagall?" Harry Potter said. "I told the headmaster I'd like to be left alone for a while."
She couldn't think of anything to say.
"To help you. You're not all right."
But she didn't know what to say. There was nothing she could imagine saying that would make things better. She hadn't planned ahead before she'd walked into the room, having not been at her best.
"What are you thinking about?"
Minerva said. It was the only sentence that came into her mind. Albus had told her that Harry had been saying, over and over, that he was thinking, and that she had to get Harry talking somehow. Harry stared half at her and half past her, attention coming into his face as she held her breath. It took a while before Harry spoke.
"I'm trying to think if there's anything I should be doing right now," said Harry Potter. "It's hard, though. My mind keeps on imagining ways the past could have gone differently if I'd thought faster, and I can't rule out that there might be a key insight in there somewhere."
"Mr. Potter,"
she said falteringly.
"Harry, I don't think it's healthy for you to be thinking like that.
I disagree. It's not thinking that gets people killed.
The words were spoken in a level monotone, as though reciting lines from a book.
Harry,
she said, hardly even thinking as she said it.
There's nothing you could have done.
Something flickered in Harry's expression. His eyes seemed to focus on her for the first time.
Nothing I could have done?
Harry's voice rose on the last word.
Nothing I could have done. I've lost track of how many different ways I could have saved her. If I'd asked to have all of us given communication mirrors, if I'd insisted on Hermione being taken out of Hogwarts and put in a school that isn't insane, if I'd snuck out immediately instead of trying to argue with normal people, if I'd remembered the Patronus earlier, if I'd thought through possible emergencies and trained myself to think about Patronuses earlier, even at the very last minute, it might not have been too late. I killed the troll and turned to her, and she was still alive, and I just knelt next to her, listening to her last words like an idiot, instead of casting the Patronus again and calling Dumbledore to send Forks. Or, if I'd just approached the whole problem from a different angle. If I looked for a student with a time-turner to send a message back in time before I found out about anything happening to her, instead of ending up with an outcome that can't be altered. I asked the headmaster to go back and save Hermione, and then fake everything. Fake the dead body, edit everyone's memories. But Dumbledore said that he tried something like that once and it didn't work, and he lost another friend instead. Or if I'd only gone with... if that night...
Harry pressed his hands over his face, and when he removed them again, his face was calm and composed once more.
Anyway,
said Harry Potter, now in a monotone again,
I don't want to repeat that mistake, so I'm going to spend until dinner time thinking if there's anything I should be doing. If I haven't thought of anything by then, I'll go to dinner and eat. Now please, go away.
She was aware now that tears were sliding down her cheeks again.
Harry, you have to believe that this isn't your fault.
Of course it's my fault. There's no one else here who could be responsible for anything.
No. You know who killed Hermione.
She was hardly aware of what she was saying, that she hadn't screened the room against who might be listening.
Not you. No matter what else you could have done, it's not you who killed her. It was Voldemort. If you can't believe that, you'll go mad, Harry.
That's not how responsibility works, Professor.
Harry's voice was patient, like he was explaining things to a child who was certain not to understand. He wasn't looking at her anymore, just staring off at the wall to her right side.
When you do a fault analysis, there's no point in assigning fault to a part of the system you can't change afterward. It's like stepping off a cliff and blaming gravity. Gravity isn't going to change next time. There's no point in trying to allocate responsibility to people who aren't going to alter their actions. Once you look at it from that perspective, you realize that allocating blame never helps anything unless you blame yourself, because you're the only one whose actions you can change by putting blame there. That's why Dumbledore has his room full of broken wands. He understands that part, at least.
some distant part of her mind made a note to wait until much later, and then speak sharply to the headmaster about what he was showing to impressionable young children. She might even scream at him this time. She'd been thinking about screaming at him anyway, because of Miss Granger.
"You're not responsible," she said, though her voice trembled. "It's the professors. It's us who are responsible for student safety, not you."
Harry's eyes flicked back to her.
"You're responsible."
There was a tightness in the voice.
"You want me to hold you responsible, Professor McGonagall?"
She raised her chin and nodded. It would be better, by far, than Harry blaming himself. The boy pushed himself up from where he was sitting on the floor and took a step forward.
"All right, then," Harry said in a monotone. "I tried to do the sensible thing when I saw Hermione was missing and that none of the professors knew. I asked for a seventh-year student to go with me on a broomstick and protect me while we were looking for Hermione. I asked for help. I begged for help. And nobody helped me. Because you gave everyone an absolute order to stay in one place or they'd be expelled. No excuses. No matter what else Dumbledore gets wrong, he at least thinks of his students as people, not animals that have to be herded into a pen and kept from wandering out. You knew you weren't any good at military thinking. Your first idea was to have us walking through the hallways. You knew some students were better than you at strategy and tactics, and you still nailed us down in one room without any discretionary judgment. So, when something you didn't foresee happened, and it would have made perfect sense to send out a seventh-year student on a fast broom to look for Hermione Granger, the students knew you wouldn't understand or forgive. They weren't afraid of the troll. They were afraid of you. The discipline, the conformity, the cowardice that you instilled in them delayed me just long enough for Hermione to die. Not that I should have tried asking for help from normal people, of course, and I will change and be less stupid next time. But if I were dumb enough to allocate responsibility to someone who isn't me, that's what I'd say."
Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
"That's what I'd tell you if I thought you could be responsible for anything. But normal people don't choose on the basis of consequences. They just play roles. There's a picture in your head of a stern disciplinarian, and you do whatever that picture would do, whether or not it makes any sense. A stern disciplinarian would order the students back to their rooms, even if there was a troll roaming the hallways. A stern disciplinarian would order students not to leave the hall on pain of expulsion. And the little picture of Professor McGonagall that you have in your head can't learn from experience or change herself. So there isn't any point in this conversation. People like you aren't responsible for anything. People like me are. And when we fail, there's no one else to blame."
The boy strode forward to stand directly before her. His hand darted beneath his robes, brought forth the golden sphere that was the ministry-issued protective shell of his time-turner. He spoke in a dead, level voice, without any emphasis.
"This could have saved Hermione if I'd been able to use it. But you thought it was your role to shut me down and get in my way. Nobody has died in Hogwarts in 50 years. You said that when you locked it. Do you remember? I should have asked again after Bellatrix Black got loose from Azkaban, or after Hermione got framed for attempted murder. But I forgot,
because I was stupid. Please unlock it now before any of my other friends die."
Unable to speak, she brought forth her wand and did so, releasing the time-keyed enchantment she had laced into the shell's lock. Harry Potter flipped open the golden shell, looked at the tiny glass hourglass within its circles, nodded, and then snapped the case shut.
"Thank you. Now go away."
The boy's voice cracked again.
"I have to think."
She closed the door behind her, an awful and still mostly muffled sound escaping her throat. Albus shimmered into existence beside her, taking on a brief garish hue as the disillusionment wore off. She did not jump, quite.
"I've told you, stop doing that,"
Minerva said. Her voice sounded dull in her own ears.
"It was private."
Albus flickered his fingers at the door behind her.
"I was afraid Mr. Potter might do you some harm."
The headmaster paused, then said quietly,
"I am very surprised that you stood there and took that."
"All I had to do was say, Mr. Potter, and he would have stopped."
Her voice had dropped almost to a whisper.
"Just that. And he would have stopped. And then he would have had no one to say those awful things to. No one at all."
"I thought Mr. Potter's remarks were entirely unfair and undeserved,"
Albus said.
"If it had been you, Albus, you would not have threatened to expel anyone leaving the room. Can you honestly tell me otherwise?"
Albus's brows rose.
"Your role in this disaster was tiny. Your decisions quite sensible at the time. And it is only Harry Potter's perfect hindsight that lets him imagine otherwise. Surely you are wiser than to blame yourself for this, Minerva."
She knew perfectly well that Albus would be placing a picture of Hermione in that awful room of his, that it would occupy a place of honour. Albus would hold himself responsible, she was certain, even though he hadn't even been in Hogwarts at the time. But not her.
"So, you also don't think it's worth the trouble of holding me responsible?"
She slumped against the nearest wall, trying not to let the tears emerge again. She'd never seen Albus weep, save thrice.
"You've always believed in your students, as I never have. They would not have been afraid of you. They would have known you would understand."
"Minerva!"
"I am not fit to succeed you as headmistress. We both know it."
"You are wrong,"
Albus said quietly.
"When the time comes, you will be the 45th headmistress of Hogwarts, and you will do an excellent job of it."
She shook her head.
"What now, Albus? If he'll not listen to me, then who?"
It was perhaps half an hour later. The boy still guarded the door to where his best friend's body lay, sitting his vigil. He was staring downward at his wand as it lay in his hands. Sometimes his face screwed up in thought, at other times it relaxed. Although the door did not open and there was no sound, the boy looked up. He composed his face. His voice, when he spoke, was dull.
"I don't want company."
The door opened. The defense professor of Hogwarts entered into the room and shut the door behind him, taking up careful position in a corner between two walls, as far away from the boy as the room permitted. A sharp sense of catastrophe had risen in the air between the two of them, and hung there unchanged.
"Why are you here?"
said the boy. The man tilted his head slightly. Pale eyes examined the boy as though he were a specimen of life from a distant planet, and correspondingly dangerous.
"I've come to apologize, Mr. Potter," the man said quietly.
"Apologize for what?"
the boy said.
"Why, what could you have done to prevent Hermione's death?"
"I should have thought to check for the presence of yourself, Mr. Longbottom, and Miss Granger, all of whom were obvious next targets,"
the defense professor said without hesitation.
"Mr. Hagrid was not mentally equipped to command the student contingent. I should have ignored the deputy headmistress's request for silence and told her to leave behind Professor Flitwick, who would have been better able to defend the students from any threat, and who could have maintained communication via Patronus."
"Correct."
The boy's voice was razor sharp.
"I'd forgotten there was someone else in Hogwarts who could be responsible for things. So, why didn't you think of it, Professor? Because I don't believe that you were stupid."
There was a pause, and the boy's fingers whitened on his wand.
"You did not think of it either, Mr. Potter, at the time."
There was a weariness in the defense professor's voice.
"I am smarter than you. I think faster than you. I am more experienced than you. But the gap between the two of us is not the same as the gap between us and them. If you can miss something, then so can I."
The man's lips twisted.
"You see, I deduced at once that the troll was but a distraction from some other matter, and of no great importance in itself. So long as nobody sent the students wandering pointlessly through the halls, or uncaringly dispatched the young Slytherins to those very dungeons where the troll had been spotted."
The boy did not seem to relax.
"I suppose that is plausible."
"In any case," said the man, "if there is anyone who can be said to be responsible for Miss Granger's death, it is myself, not you. It is I, not you, who should have..."
"I perceive that you have spoken to Professor McGonagall, and that she has given you a script to follow."
The boy didn't bother keeping the bitterness from his voice.
"If you have something to say to me, Professor, say it without the masks."
There was a pause.
"As you wish,"
the defense professor said emotionlessly. The pale eyes stayed keen and sharp.
"I do regret that the girl is dead. She was a good student in my defense class, and could have been an ally to you later. I wish to console you for your loss, but I cannot see how to go about doing so. Naturally, if I find the ones responsible, I shall kill them. You are welcome to join in, should circumstances permit."
"How touching,"
the boy said, his voice cool.
"You're not claiming to have liked Hermione, then?"
"Her charms were lost on me, I suspect. I no longer form such bonds easily."
The boy nodded.
"Thank you for being honest. Is that all, Professor?"
There was a pause.
"The castle is scarred now,"
said the man standing in the corner.
What? When a certain ancient device in my possession informed me that Miss Granger was on the verge of death, I cast that spell of cursed fire of which I once spoke. I burned through some walls and floors so that my broomstick could take a more direct path.
The man still spoke tonelessly.
Hogwarts will not heal such wounds easily, if at all. I suppose it will be necessary to patch over the holes with lesser conjurations. I regret that now, since I was in any case too late.
Ah,
said the boy. He closed his eyes briefly.
You did want to save her. You wanted it so strongly that you made some sort of actual effort. I suppose your mind, if not theirs, would be capable of that.
A brief, dry smile from the man.
Thank you for that, Professor. But I would like to be left alone until dinner time. You, of all people, will understand. Is that all?
Not quite,
the man said, a tinge of sardonic dryness now returned to his voice.
You see, based on recent experiences, I am concerned that you may now intend to do something extremely foolish.
Such as what? Said the boy.
I am not quite sure. Perhaps you have decided that a universe without Miss Granger is devoid of value and should be destroyed for the insults it has dealt you.
The boy smiled without any humor.
Your own issues are showing, Professor. I don't really go in for that sort of thing. Did you at some point?
Not particularly. I have no great fondness for the universe, but I do live there.
There was a pause.
What are you planning, Mr. Potter?
Said the man in the corner.
You have come to some significant resolution, though you are trying to hide it from me. What do you now intend?
The boy shook his head.
I'm still thinking, and would like to be left alone to do it.
I recall an offer you once made to me some months ago, said the defense professor. Do you want someone intelligent to talk to? I will understand if you are not pleasant to be around.
The boy shook his head again.
No, thank you.
Well then, said the defense professor, what about someone who is powerful and not particularly bound by naive scruples?
There was a hesitation, and then the boy once more shook his head.
Someone who is knowledgeable of much secret lore and magics that some might consider to be unnatural.
There was a slight narrowing of the boy's eyes, so imperceptible that someone else might not have.
I see, said the defense professor. Go ahead and ask me about it, then. I give you my word that I will repeat nothing of it to the others.
The boy took a while to speak, and when he did, it was in a cracked voice.
I mean to bring Hermione back, because there isn't an afterlife, and I'm not about to just let her just not be.
The boy pressed his hands over his face, and when he withdrew them, he once more seemed as dispassionate as the man standing in the corner. The defense professor's eyes were abstract and faintly puzzled.
How?
The man said finally.
However, I have to.
There was another pause.
"Regardless of the risks," the man in the corner said, "regardless of how dangerous the magic required to accomplish it."
"Yes."
The defense professor's eyes were thoughtful.
"But what general approach did you have in mind? I presume that turning her corpse into an inferus is not what you..."
"Would she be able to think?" the boy said. "Would her body still decay?"
"No and yes."
"Then no."
"What of the resurrection stone of Cadmus Peverell, if it could be obtained for you?"
The boy shook his head.
"I don't want an illusion of Hermione drawn from my memories. I want her to be able to live her life."
The boy's voice cracked.
"I haven't decided yet on an object-level angle of attack. If I have to brute-force the problem by acquiring enough power and knowledge to just make it happen, I will."
Another pause. "And to go about that," the man in the corner said, "you will use your favorite tool, science."
"Of course."
The defense professor exhaled, almost like a sigh.
"I suppose that makes sense of it."
"Are you willing to help or not?" the boy said.
"What help do you seek?"
"Magic. Where does it come from?"
"I do not know," said the man.
"And neither does anyone else?"
"Oh, the situation is far worse than that, Mr. Potter. There is hardly a scholar of the esoteric who has not unraveled the nature of magic, and every one of them believes something different."
"Where do new spells come from? I keep reading about someone who invented a spell to do something or other, but there's no mention of how."
A shrug of robed shoulders.
"Where do new books come from, Mr. Potter? Those who read many books sometimes become able to write them in turn. How? No one knows."
"There are books on how to write."
"Reading them will not make you a famous playwright. After all such advice is accounted for, what remains is mystery. The invention of new spells is a similar mystery of purer form."
The man's head tilted.
"Such endeavors are dangerous. The saying is that one should either not have children or else wait until they are grown. There is a reason why so many innovators seem to hail from Gryffindor rather than Ravenclaw, as might be expected."
"And the more powerful sorts of magics?"
the boy said.
"A legendary wizard might invent one sacrificial ritual in his life and pass on the knowledge to his heirs. To try inventing 5 such would be suicide. That is why wizards of true power are those who have acquired ancient lore."
The boy nodded distantly.
"So much for the direct solution, then. It would have been nice to just invent a spell for raise dead, become god, or summon terminal. Do you know anything about Atlantis?"
"Only what any scholar knows," the man said dryly. "If you would like to hear about the top 18 standard theories, do not glare at me, Mr. Potter. If it were that simple, I would have done it many years earlier."
I understand. Sorry.
There was a time of silence. The defense professor's gaze rested on the boy. The boy stared off, seemingly at nothing.
There's some magics I mean to learn. Spells I could have used earlier today, if I'd thought to study them beforehand.
The boy's voice was cold.
Spells I need, if this sort of thing goes on happening. Most I expect I can just look up. Some I expect I can't.
The defense professor inclined his head.
I shall teach you almost any magic you wish to know, Mr. Potter. I do have some limits, but you may always ask. But what specifically do you seek? You lack the raw power for the killing curse and most other spells deemed forbidden.
That spell of cursed fire, I don't suppose it's a sacrificial ritual that even a child could use, if he dared?
The defense professor's lips twitched.
It requires the permanent sacrifice of a drop of blood. Your body would be lighter by that drop of blood from that day forward. Not the sort of thing one would wish to do often, Mr. Potter. Strength of will is demanded for the cursed fire not to turn upon you and consume you. The usual practice is to first test one's will in lesser trials. And although it is not a primary element of the ritual, I am afraid that it does require more magic than you shall possess for another few years.
Pity, the boy said. It would have been nice to see the look on the enemy's face the next time they tried using a troll.
The defense professor inclined his head, his lips twitching again.
What about memory charms? The Weasley twins were acting oddly, and the headmaster said he thinks they've been obliviated. It seems to be one of the enemy's favorite tricks.
Rule 8, said the defense professor. Any technique which is good enough to defeat me once is good enough to learn myself.
The boy smiled humorlessly.
And I once heard about an adult casting Obliviate while she was almost completely drained, so it must not take too much magic to cast. It's not even considered unforgivable, though I can't imagine why not. If I could have made Mr. Hagrid remember a different set of orders...
It is not that straightforward, said the defense professor. You are not powerful enough to use the false memory charm, and even a simple obliviation will stretch the edge of your current stamina. It is a dangerous art, illegal to use without ministry authorization, and I would caution you not to use it under circumstances where it would be inconvenient to accidentally erase 10 years of someone's life. I wish I could promise you that I would obtain one of those highly guarded tomes from the Department of Mysteries and pass it to you beneath the disguised cover. But what I must actually tell you is that you will find the standard introductory text in the northwest stacks of the main Hogwarts library, filed under M.
Seriously? The boy said flatly.
Indeed.
Thank you for your guidance, Professor.
Your creativity has become a great deal more practical, Mr. Potter, since I have known you.
Thank you for the compliment.
The boy did not look up from where he was again, gazing down at the wand held between his hands.
I would like to go back to thinking now. Please explain to them on my behalf what happens if I am disturbed.
The door to the storeroom clicked open, and Professor Quirrell stepped out. His face had a dead, emotionless look on it.
she would have said that it reminded her of Severus, though Severus had never looked quite like that. Even as the door clicked shut again, Minerva had thrown up a wordless quieting barrier. The words spilled forth from her rapidly.
How did it go? You were in there for a while. Is Harry talking now?
Professor Quirrell paced swiftly across the room to the far wall near the entrance, looked back at her. The emotionlessness slid off his face, as though he were taking off a mask, leaving behind someone very grim.
"I spoke to Mr. Potter as he expected me to speak, and avoided saying things that would annoy him. I do not think it consoled him. I do not think I have the knack."
"Thank you. It is good that he spoke at all."
She hesitated.
"What did Mr. Potter say?"
"I am afraid that I promised him not to speak of it. And now, I think that I must visit the Hogwarts library."
"The library?"
"Yes," Professor Quirrell said.
An uncharacteristic tension had come into his voice.
"I intend to strengthen the security upon the restricted section with certain precautions of my own devising. The current wards are a joke, and Mr. Potter must be kept out of the restricted section at all costs."
She stared at the defense professor, her heart suddenly in her throat. Professor Quirrell continued speaking.
"You will not tell the boy that I have said this much to you. You will confirm to Flitwick and Vector that the boy is to be diverted by the usual evasions if he asks precocious questions about spell creation. And though it is not my own area of expertise, Deputy Headmistress, if there is any way you can imagine to convince the boy to stop sinking further into his grief and madness, any way at all to undo the resolutions he is coming to, then I suggest you resort to it immediately."
Chapter 91 Roles, Part 2. Shortly after, there was another knock upon the storeroom door.
"If you actually care about my mental health," the boy said without looking up, "you will go away, leave me alone, and wait for me to come down to dinner. This isn't helping."
The door opened, and the one who had waited outside stepped in.
"Seriously?" the boy said flatly.
The door closed and clicked behind Severus Snape. The potions master of Hogwarts wore none of his customary arrogance, or even the dispassionate guise that he ordinarily took in the headmaster's office. His gaze was strange as he looked down upon the boy guarding that door, his thoughts unfathomable.
"I also cannot imagine what the deputy headmistress is thinking," said the potions master of Hogwarts. "Unless I am meant to serve as a warning of where it will lead you, if you decide to take the blame for her death upon yourself."
The boy's lips pressed together.
"Fine. Let's just skip ahead to the end of this conversation. You win, Professor Snape. I concede that you were more responsible for Lily Potter's death than I was responsible for Hermione Granger's death, and that my guilt can't stack up to your guilt. And then I ask you to go, and you tell them that it would probably be best to let me alone for a while. Are we done?"
"Almost," the potions master said. "I am the one who put the notes under Miss Granger's pillow, telling her where to find the fights in which she intervened."
The boy did not react to this at all. Finally, he spoke. "Because you dislike bullying."
"Not that alone."
There was a note of pain in the potions master's voice that sounded alien to it. It was hard to imagine it being the same acid voice that instructed children not to stir one more time or they'd blow off their wrists.
"I should have realized it very much earlier, I suppose. And yet I did not see it at all, being entirely absorbed in myself. For me to be placed as head of Slytherin, it means that Albus Dumbledore has entirely lost hope that Slytherin House can be helped. I am certain that Dumbledore must have tried. I cannot imagine that he did not try when he first took trust of Hogwarts. It must have been a severe blow to him, when after that so much of Slytherin answered to the Dark Lord's call. He would not have placed me in authority over that house, acting as I did, unless he had lost all hope."
The potions master's shoulders fell beneath his spotted and stained cloak.
"But you and Miss Granger were trying to do something, and the two of you had even managed to bring over Mr. Malfoy and Miss Greengrass, and perhaps those two could have set a different example. I suppose it was foolish for me to believe. The headmaster does not know what I have done, and I ask you not to tell him."
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Matters have become far too serious not to tell someone."
Severus Snape's lips twisted.
"I have seen enough disastrous plotting in my tenure as head of Slytherin to know how that sometimes goes. If, in the future, all should come to light, then at least I have told you, and you may say as much."
"Lovely," the boy said. "Thank you for clearing that up. Is that all?"
"Do you intend to declare that your life is now a ruin, and that there is nothing left for you but vengeance?"
"No, but I still have..."
The boy cut himself off.
"Then there is very little advice that I can give you," said Severus Snape.
The boy nodded distantly.
"On Hermione's behalf, thank you for helping her with the bullies. She would tell you that it was the right thing to do. And now I would be much obliged if you could tell them to leave me alone."
The potions master turned to the door, and when his face was unseen, his voice came in a whisper.
"I truly am sorry for your loss."
Severus Snape departed. The boy stared after him, trying to remember, as best he could at this distance, words which had been spoken some time earlier.
"Your books betrayed you, Potter. They did not tell you the one thing you needed to know. You cannot learn from books what it is like to lose the one you love. That is something you could never know without experiencing it for yourself."
It had gone something like that, the boy thought,
if he was remembering correctly. Hours had passed now, in the infirmary section with its closed door and a body lying in state behind it. Harry went on staring at his wand as it lay in his lap, at the tiny scratches and smudges on the 11 inches of holly, flaws that he never looked closely enough to notice before. A quick mental calculation said that there was no reason to worry, since if this was 6 or 7 months' accumulation of damage, then a standard lifetime wouldn't wear away the wand entirely. At the time, he probably would have worried about his own time-turner being taken away if he'd just openly yelled out, "Does anyone have a time-turner?" into the Great Hall. But it would have been easy enough to pre-commit to, after lunch, finding someone to send Professor Flitwick a message 2 hours earlier, and then Professor Flitwick could have just gone straight to Hermione or sent her his Raven Patronus long before the troll was anywhere near her. Or might that alternate Harry have already learned it was too late? Heard about Hermione's death after lunch and before he could buy any messages sent backwards in time. Maybe a basic guideline of working with time travel was to make sure you never risked learning you were too late, if you hadn't yet gone backwards. There was a tiny chemical burn now on the end of his wand, presumably from contacting the acid he'd partially transfigured the troll's brain into, but the wand seemed robust against losses of small amounts of wood. Really, the concept of a magic wand being required just got stranger the more you thought about it. Though, if spells were always being invented in some mysterious way, new rituals being carved as new levers upon the unknown machine, it might just be that people just kept inventing rituals that involved wands, just like they invented phrases like Wingardium Leviosa. It really seemed like magic ought to be, in some sense, almost arbitrarily powerful, and it certainly would be convenient if Harry could just bypass whatever conceptual limitation prevented people from inventing spells like just fix everything forever, but somehow nothing was ever that easy where magic was concerned. Harry looked at his mechanical watch again, but it still wasn't time. He'd attempted to cast the Patronus charm, meaning to tell his Patronus to go to Hermione Granger, just in case it was all a lie, a false memory charm, or one of the who knew how many ways that wizards could be made to close their eyes and dream. Just in case the real Hermione was alive and being held somewhere, despite his feeling her life as it left her. Just in case there was an afterlife, and the true Patronus could reach it. The spell hadn't worked, though, so that particular test had failed to provide any evidence, leaving him with the previous unfavorable prior. Time passed, and yet more time. From the outside, you'd have just seen a boy, sitting, staring at his wand with an abstract gaze, looking at his watch every 2 minutes or so. The door to the infirmary section opened once again. The boy sitting there looked up with a deadly, chilling glare. Then the boy's face cracked in dismay, and he scrambled to his feet.
"Harry!"
said the man in a button-down formal shirt and a black vest thrown over it. His voice was hoarse.
"Harry, what's happening? The headmaster of your school. He showed up in those ridiculous robes at my office and told me that Hermione Granger was dead."
A moment later, a woman followed the man into the room. She seemed less confused than the man, less bewildered, and more frightened.
"Dad!" the boy said thinly. "Mum! Yes? She's dead? They didn't tell you anything else?"
"No, Harry, what's happening?"
There was a pause.
The boy slumped back against the wall.
I can't do this.
What?
I can't pretend to be a little boy. I just don't have the energy right now.
Harry,
the woman said falteringly.
Harry.
Dad, you know those fantasy books where the hero has to hide everything from his parents because they wouldn't understand, and they would react stupidly and get in the hero's way? It's a plot device, right? So that the hero has to solve everything himself instead of telling his parents. Please, don't be that plot device, Dad. Or you either, Mum. Just don't play that role. Don't be the parents who won't understand. Don't yell at me and give me parental demands that I can't follow. 'Cause I've wandered into a bloody stupid fantasy novel and now Hermione's... I just don't have the energy to deal with it.
Slowly, as though his limbs were only half animated, the man in the black vest kneeled down to where Harry was standing, so that his eyes were level with his son's.
Harry, the man said, I need you to tell me everything that has happened right now.
The boy took a deep breath, swallowed.
They tell me the Dark Lord I defeated may still be alive. Like, that's not the plot of 100 sodding books, right? So, it could also be that the headmaster of my school, who's the most powerful wizard in the world, has gone insane. And Hermione was framed for an attempted murder just before this. Not that anyone would have told her parents about it or anything. The student she was framed for attempted murdering was the son of Lucius Malfoy, who's the most powerful politician in magical Britain and used to be the Dark Lord's number two. The defense professor position at this school has a curse on it. Nobody ever lasts more than a year. They have a saying that the defense professor is always a suspect. This year, the defense professor is secretly a mysterious wizard who opposed the Dark Lord during the last war and may or may not be evil himself. Also, the potions master has been pining after Lily Potter for years and might be behind this whole thing for some twisted psychological reason.
The boy's lips pressed together bitterly.
I think that's most of the bloody stupid plots.
The man who had listened to all this quietly stood up. He put a gentle hand on the boy's shoulder.
That's enough, Harry, he said. I've heard enough. We're leaving this school right now and taking you with us.
The woman was looking at the boy, her face asking a question. The boy gazed back at her and nodded. The woman's voice was thin when she spoke.
They won't let us, Michael.
They have no legal right to stop us.
Right. You're muggles,
said the boy. He smiled twistedly.
You have as much standing in the magical British legal system as mice. No wizard is going to care about any arguments you make about rights, about fairness. They won't even take the time to listen. You don't have any power, see? So they don't have to bother. No, Mum, I'm not smiling like this because I agree with their muggle policies. I'm smiling because I disagree with your children policies.
Then, Professor Michael Verus Evans said firmly, we shall see what the real government has to say about that.
I know an MP or three. They'll say, you're crazy. Have a nice day in this asylum. That's assuming the Ministry Obliviators don't get to you first and erase your memories. They do that to muggles a lot, I hear. I figure the real higher-ups in our government have formed some cozy accommodations of their own. Maybe they get a few healing charms now and then if someone important manages to get cancer.
The boy gave that twisted smile again.
And that's the situation, Dad. as Mum already knows. They'd never have brought you here, or told you anything, if there was a single thing you could do about it."
The man's mouth opened, but no words came out, as though he had been reading from a script which described what a concerned parent ought to do in this sort of situation, and this script had suddenly arrived at a blank spot.
"Harry,"
the woman said falteringly. The boy looked at her.
"Harry, did something happen to you? You seem different."
"Petunia," the man said, his tongue apparently working once more. "Don't say such things. He's under stress, that's all."
"Well, Mum, you see,"
the boy's voice cracked.
"Are you sure you want this all at once, Mum?"
The woman nodded, though she didn't speak.
"I've got... You know how that school psychiatrist thought I had anger management problems? Well..."
The boy stopped and swallowed.
"I don't know how to explain this to you, Mum. It's something magical instead. Probably something to do with whatever happened on the night my parents died. I have... Well, I was calling it a mysterious dark side. And I know it sounds like a joke, and I did check with an ancient telepathic magical hat to make sure my scar wasn't actually inhabited by the Dark Lord spirit, and it said that there was only one person under its brim, and I don't think wizards have actual souls anyway, since they can still suffer from brain damage, only..."
"Harry, slow down," said the man.
Only, whatever it is, it's still real. There's something inside me. It gave me willpower when things were bad. I could face down anything so long as I was angry. Snape, Dumbledore, the entire Wizengamot. My dark side wasn't afraid of anything but Dementors. And I wasn't stupid. I knew that there might be a price for using my dark side, and I kept on looking to see what the price might be. It didn't change my magic. It didn't seem to cause permanent alignment shift. It didn't try to take me away from my friends or anything like that, so I kept on using it whenever I had to. And I only figured out too late what the price really was."
The boy's voice had become almost a whisper.
"I only figured out today. Every time I call on it, it uses up my childhood. I killed the thing that got Hermione. And it wasn't my dark side that did it. It was me. Mum, Dad, I'm sorry."
There was a long silence, filled with the sound of broken masks.
"Harry," the man said, kneeling down again, "I need you to start over from the beginning and explain that much more slowly."
The boy spoke. The parents listened. Some time later, the father stood up. The boy looked up at him, grimacing in bitter anticipation.
"Harry," the man said, "Petunia and I are going to get you out of here as quickly as possible."
"Don't," the boy said warningly. "I mean it, Dad. The Ministry of Magic isn't something you can stand up to. Pretend they're the tax office, or the dean, or something else that won't brook any challenge to their dominance. In magical Britain, you're only allowed to remember what the government thinks you should remember. And remembering the existence of magic, or that you have a son named Harry, is a privilege, not a right. And if they did that, I'd crack and turn the ministry into a giant flaming crater. Mum, you know the score. You absolutely have to stop Dad from trying anything stupid."
"And son,"
the man rubbed at his temples,
Maybe I should say this now. But are you sure what you're talking about is really a magical dark side, and not something normal for a boy your age?
Normal?
The boy said with elaborate patience.
Normal how, exactly? I could check again, but I'm reasonably sure there wasn't anything about this in Childcraft, A Guide for Parents. My dark side isn't just an emotional state, it makes me smarter. In some ways, anyhow. You can't just pretend yourself smarter.
The man rubbed at his head again.
Well, there's a certain well-known phenomenon wherein children undergo a biological process which can sometimes make them angry and dark and grim, and this process also significantly increases their intelligence and their height.
The boy slumped back against the wall.
No, Dad, it's not that I'm turning into a teenager. I checked with my brain, and it still thinks that girls are icky. But if that's what you want to pretend, then fine. Maybe I'm better off with you not believing me. I just...
The boy's voice choked.
I just couldn't stand lying about it.
Adolescence doesn't necessarily work like that, Harry. It may still take a while for you to notice girls, if in fact you haven't noticed one or...
And the man abruptly stopped.
I didn't like Hermione in that way,
the boy whispered.
Why does everyone keep thinking it has to be about that? It's disrespectful to her to think someone can only like her in that way.
The man swallowed visibly.
Anyway, son, you keep yourself safe while we work on getting you out of here. Is that understood? Don't you go actually thinking that you've turned to the dark side. I know you've had what I used to call your Ender Wiggin moments.
I think we are now well past Ender, and on to Ender after the buggers kill Valentine. Language!
Said the woman, and then her hand flew to cover her mouth. The boy spoke wearily.
Not that kind of bugger, Mum. They're insectoid aliens. Never mind.
Harry, that's exactly what I'm saying you shouldn't think,
Professor Varys Evans said firmly.
You're not going to believe that you're turning evil. You are not to hurt anyone. Place yourself in harm's way, or mess around with any sort of black magic whatsoever, while your mum and I work on extracting you from this situation. Is that clear, son?
The boy closed his eyes.
That'd be wonderful advice, Dad. If only I were in a comic book.
Harry, the man began.
Police can't do that. Soldiers can't do that. The most powerful wizard in the world couldn't do that, and he tried. It's not fair to the innocent bystanders to play at being Batman if you can't actually protect anyone under that code. And I've just proven that I can't.
Beads of sweat were glistening on Professor Michael Varys Evans's forehead.
Now you listen to me. No matter what you've read in books, you aren't supposed to be protecting anyone, or involving yourself in anything dangerous. Absolutely anything dangerous whatsoever. Just stay out of the way of everything, every bit of craziness going on in this madhouse, while we get you out of here the first instant we possibly can.
The boy looked searchingly at his father, then his mother, then he looked at his wristwatch again.
"Excellent point," said the boy.
The boy marched over to the door leading outward and flung it open. The door flew open with a crack that caused Minerva to startle where she stood, and before she had time to think, Harry Potter marched out of the room, glaring directly at her.
"You brought my parents here," the boy who lived said, "to Hogwarts, where you know who or someone is lurking around targeting my friends. What exactly were you thinking?"
She didn't reply that she had been thinking about Harry sitting in front of the door to the storeroom containing Hermione's body, refusing to move.
"Who else knows about this?" Harry Potter demanded. "Did anyone see them with you?"
"The headmaster brought them here.
I want them out of here immediately, before anyone else notices, especially you-know-who, but also including Professor Quirrell or Professor Snape. Please send your Patronus to the headmaster and tell him that he needs to bring them back at once. Do not mention my parents by name or as people in case someone else is listening."
"Indeed," said Professor Varys Evans, nodding sternly along with this from where he stood directly behind the boy, Petunia a step behind him. His hand rested firmly on Harry's shoulder.
"We'll finish talking to our son at home."
"A moment, please,"
Minerva said in reflexive politeness. Her first try at casting the Patronus failed, a disadvantage of that charm under certain circumstances. It wasn't the first time she'd done it so, but she seemed to have lost some of the knack. Minerva shut the thought down and concentrated. When the message was sent, she turned back to Professor Varys Evans.
"Sir,"
she said,
"I'm afraid that Mr. Potter must not leave the Hogwarts school."
By the time Albus finally arrived, there was shouting, the Muggle man having given up on dignity. At least there was shouting on one side of the argument. Minerva's heart wasn't in it. The truth was that she couldn't believe the words coming out of her mouth. When the professor turned to argue with the headmaster, Harry Potter, who had remained silent through this, spoke up.
"Not here," said Harry. "You can argue with him anywhere but Hogwarts, Dad. Mum, please, please make sure that Dad doesn't try anything that will get him in trouble with the Ministry."
Michael Varys Evans's face screwed up. He turned, looked at Harry Potter. When his voice came out, it was hoarse, accompanied by water in his eyes.
"Son, what are you doing?"
"You know perfectly well what I'm doing," Harry Potter said. "You read those comic books long before you gave them to me. I've been through a bunch of crap, matured a bit, and now I'm protecting my relatives. Actually, it's simpler than that. You know what I'm doing because you tried to do the same thing. I'm having my loved ones taken out of Hogwarts immediately. That's what I'm doing. Headmaster, please get them out of here before you know who discovers their presence and marks them for death."
Michael Varys Evans began a frantic dash toward Harry, and then all motion stopped, with the Muggle man leaning forward in his flight.
"I am sorry," the headmaster said quietly. "We shall speak more soon. Minerva, I was with the others when you called. They are waiting in your office."
The headmaster passed forward like he was gliding, until he stood in the midst of where the man and woman stood frozen, and there was another flash of flame. Motion resumed. Minerva looked at Harry. Words did not come to her.
"Clever move, bringing them here," Harry Potter said. "Probably damaged our relationship permanently. All I wanted was to be bloody left alone until bloody dinner time, which..."
The boy looked at his wristwatch.
"It now is, anyway.
I'm going to go say goodbye to Hermione by myself, which I promise will take less than 2 minutes. And then after that, I'll come out and go eat something like I would have done regardless. Do not disturb me for those 2 bloody minutes, or I will snap and try to kill someone. I mean it, Professor.
The boy turned and strode into the small room, opened the rear door to where Hermione Granger's body was being kept, and strode inside before she could think to speak. Through the doorway she saw a flash of a sight she knew no child ought to see. The door slammed shut. She started forwards, unthinking. Halfway to the door she stopped herself. Her mind was still slow and hurting, and the part of her that Harry Potter would have called the picture of a stern disciplinarian was lifelessly mouthing words about inappropriate behaviour from children. The rest of her didn't think it was a good idea to leave any child, even Harry Potter, alone in a room with the bloody corpse of his best friend. But the act of opening the door, or asserting any sort of authority, did not seem to her wise. There was no right thing to do, and no right thing to say. Or, if there was any right path, she did not know it. Very slowly, a minute and a half passed. When the door opened again, Harry seemed to have changed, as though that minute and a half had passed over the course of lifetimes.
"Seal up the room,"